The meeting of Education Innovation Policy will come unofficially to order. As soon as we have a quorum, I will call the meeting officially. So we will not move approval of any minutes yet, but I would like to call to the testifying table Representative Peterson to begin to explain this proposal before us. Members, this is House File 1966, which I will move as soon as we have a quorum, but we can begin our discussion of it. Welcome to our committee, Representative Peterson. Please say your name for the record and begin to explain this House File.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Representative Roz Peterson, and it is great to be back in education innovation. And today we are talking about House File 1966, which is basically a star rating system. In summary, my bill would establish an easy-to-understand star rating model to replace our current system in classifying schools. Schools would receive 1 to 4 stars based on its summative performance under the state's new ESSA laws, and it will be on an aligned accountability system. With my bill, the commissioner would still have tremendous discretion to determine what factors should be included in the new accountability system. The commissioner would simply be required to report the results back to parents, students, and community members in a transparent and easily digestible manner. Transparency and accountability is critical to the success of our students and schools. Parents need objective data on how schools are doing so that they can make informed choices about their child's education. Educators themselves need such information to understand opportunities for improvements in their schools. And we policymakers need clear data on school performance so that we can better target our efforts to help schools with the greatest need. Under the recently adopted Federal Every Student Succeeds Act, as we all know as ESSA, we have the opportunity to update our state school's accountability system. The federal law provides some guidance on what we must be in the system, but also gives states substantial discretion over what's included and how it's reported to the public. I believe we have an obligation to make most of this opportunity, empowering families, educators, and policymakers with accessible, transparent data on how our schools are or are not serving students and guidance on how to improve.
Excuse me, Representative Peterson.
Yes.
The meeting of Education Innovation Policy will officially come to order. A quorum is present. And the chair will move House File 1966 to be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Please proceed, Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I and many others worry that our current designation in the state's accountability system, such as priority, focus, reward, continuous improvement, and celebration eligible, are very confusing to families, students, teachers, and other stakeholders. I believe that a straightforward and star rating system would be a vast improvement over the confusing and vague designations we currently have. Transparent and easy to understand summative star ratings would help parents, community groups, educators, policymakers, and even students themselves understand overall how schools are performing. And I do have one testifier here as well, Madam Chair, if you want to.
Thank you, Representative Peterson, and we will call forward testifiers. Testifiers, keep in mind that you have 2 minutes to present your concerns or your support for these proposals that we're hearing this morning. Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Joshua Crossan, and I'm with Ed Allies, which is an education advocacy nonprofit working to improve public education for each and every kid in the state. Focus, celebration, reward, celebration eligible, priority, continuous improvement. Of these ratings, which do you think identifies a school that sees its kids growing exponentially? Which do you think identifies a school that fails to teach kids to read at grade level? Which do you think identifies a school that is closing its achievement gaps? Or identifies a school that is graduating more than 90% of its kids in 4 years? or is seeing English language learners gain English language proficiency. I'll say it again. Focus, celebration, reward, celebration eligible, priority, continuous improvement. If you don't know, you're not alone. Parents throughout the state are told they're sending their kids to a priority school, not realizing that that means schools struggle to meet academic benchmarks. Parents are choosing a focus school over a celebration school right next door without realizing that a celebration school more often sees extraordinary student growth, proficiency, and closure of achievement gaps. As we celebrate and promote school choice, we must also advocate for transparency with our data. Parents and kids cannot make a knowledgeable choice about which school to attend unless they first have the information they need to make that choice. What this bill does is simple. It takes our currently confusing and convoluted school category system and replaces it with a system easy to understand. This bill does not inform how MDE should develop the accountability system. It does not require testing to be the only factor in identifying great schools. It does nothing but provide transparency to parents on what the state has determined an adequate and comprehensive accountability system. 1 star, 2 star, 3 star, 4 star. This is a rating already adopted by our early learning centers. It is a clear way to provide transparency to parents and kids. And early learning advocates can attest, the star rating is also motivating programs to be better for kids. We believe this bill would advance our efforts to promote school choice and give parents and kids the information they need to meet their full potential. Thank you, and I'll be around for some questions.
Thank you, Mr. Krausen. Are there others in the audience who would like to come forward to provide support for House File 1966? Thank you. Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
My name is Kulia, and I am multiple things. I'm a parent, educator, organizer, and parent advocate. I'm here to support the bill today because, as an advocate, I can't tell you how many times I've had to explain various things that either the district or the state is sending to parents, and they have no clue. Many parents don't even know that their kids are in low-performing schools, and when they get the letter stating that their kids are in low-performing schools, they have no idea what that means. That means most of my calls come from, Kulia, what does this mean? What are they saying? What are they trying to say? And I think this system really helps give parents tools that they need to help advocate for themselves, but to also make it simple. Like I said, I just can't tell you how many times and how many calls I get where parents are just simply confused and frustrated. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Pringle. Is Toya Woodland in the audience? Thank you. Please come forward. Say your name for the record and begin.
I am Minister Toya Woodland. I am with Christ Apostolic Church in Roseville. I'm also a parent of a teenager in the Minneapolis public school system, organizer, activist, advocate for social justice. I am here as a concerned parent, not as an activist, not as an advocate, but as a concerned parent. I am concerned that parents who are not informed of the options and the choices that they have for their children their children won't have the best quality education. I've been lucky. I've been blessed. My son has been blessed to attend schools where they care about his education, where he's excelled, where education is priority for those particular schools. But I have to say that his parent's school wasn't always under the MPS logo, and that's when they excelled the most. And so it's my concern that the language in this bill makes it clear that people who are not English isn't their first language, parents that are busy, single working mothers, who can have the best choice possible for their children. I mean, the time is now. In this culture, in this day, it's time that we even the playing field, that we're all, that education, a good education is available to us all. And that's why I sit here today. And I hope, I pray that you can, it touches your heart to make sure that every child has a decent opportunity and a fair opportunity to learn.
Thank you very much, Ms. Woodland. Now, for those who may have concerns, Josh Shannon from Minneapolis Public Schools.
Good
Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Josh Downer with the Minneapolis Public Schools. And I just want to thank Representative Peterson. She and I had a good conversation about this bill yesterday after it was introduced and had the opportunity to speak with the chair this morning. We do have real concerns about this bill. I just wanted to show what a bit of a geek I am in terms of I don't know if you're familiar with the Winter Olympics. There's a sport called the biathlon.
Oh, yes.
And I had I was a Washburn High School graduate. I got a chance to do a lot of cross-country skiing. I have a great deal of respect for the folks who compete at that really high level, and they go like crazy up and down hills and go for miles, and then they stop and they shoot at targets with a rifle. It's an amazing, these folks are amazing athletes. Well, each of those athletes shoots at 5 targets. Under our current MMR system, the Minneapolis Public Schools and many of the schools in your districts have varying number of targets they have to hit. So, for example, Minneapolis, you have free and reduced lunch, English learners, special ed, African American, American Indian, Asian American, and Hispanic American. A school has to hit every single one of those targets, where other schools may only have to hit 3 targets, and yet we're judging them on the same criteria. For every complex problem, there's a simple answer, and it's wrong. And I really think that in some instances, you're going to see schools that are doing great things for students, but miss one of those targets, and they would be considered a 2. And so I'd urge the committee to take some time to think more about how this is structured. And then, Madam Chair, you and I have had conversations around the opt-out movement and what that means for Henry High School, for example, where they used to receive over 20 points on their proficiency. They now get 0 because of the opt-out. Now, would love some further discussion about this and work with the author to make some improvements. So with that, Madam Chair, I appreciate the time.
Thank you, Mr. Dunham. I believe the Department of Education would like to express some concern. Welcome, Mr. Oney. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Madam Chair, members, good morning. My name is Adosh Oney, Director of Government Relations at the Minnesota Department of Education. I had the opportunity briefly to meet with the author yesterday. I appreciate the time, and briefly in the elevator. Sometimes it works out that way. So I would say that MDE, as with similar efforts in the past, would not be supportive of this measurement. We would encourage members and the author to look towards the efforts that we're engaged in under our ESSA state plan right now. We've engaged with over 100 stakeholders on our accountability committees looking at what our accountability system is going to look like. And a lot of the focus has been more on looking at what tools, funding streams, and efforts we can have from a centralized level to assist schools to turn around. To turn around in their performance, really helping those lower-performing schools, focusing on that assistance. That's kind of the base of where the world's best workforce has started out. As you know, we're at that end of that 3-year cycle, and the department has to make the decisions about how to assist those low-performing schools. So we're looking at that as a model as we look to where we comply with our federal accountability responsibilities in how we assist these low-performing models. I think the department thinks we should continue to follow the guidance of many of these stakeholders who overwhelmingly said we need to focus on the assistance portion of it. So we want to avoid creating a system where we have several accountability systems which have different goals and different lenses and focus more on the work that we've engaged in with stakeholders around the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Oney. Members, are there questions for the author or for any of the testifiers? Who first? Oh, Representative Jessup.
Thank you, Madam Chair. These questions may be for Adosh Oney or for Josh Dunham.
Yes, why don't the testifiers stay close to the table because we have questions for you. Thank you, Mr. Oney. Maybe you want to sit down. I think Representative Jessup, is your question for the department?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Please.
We as consumers, when we're looking at a large purchase, and let's just take the example of a vehicle, a car, each of us would look at that and say, we're going to put down a significant amount of dollars, and how do we decide what is the best car choice? And so we will look, and we'll kind of gauge, and we'll look for information from the car dealers to say, okay, this car has this features, this is the benefits, these are the concerns, and then we'll look at other options as well. If I'm a parent right now in the school system, in one of these schools, and let's just, since you're here as well, let's choose a Minneapolis school, how would I as a parent today be able to compare, let's say, the three elementary schools around me? What factors would I be able to look at to understand, is this school the best choice for my child?
Mr. Uni.
Madam Chair, Representative Jessup, and members of the committee, right now, if you want to look at hard data, a parent could go to the Minnesota Report Card on Minnesota Department of Education's website, and we can look at demographic enrollments, you can look at proficiency scores, and you can look at growth measures as well. So that's a way that we can look at how those elementary schools possibly compare to the district at large, to the statewide levels on a range of different tests, and you can actually compare all three elementary schools to each other. It's a fairly user-friendly model. You know, our staff and the department would be more than happy to run through that with members at any time.
Representative Jessup, question for Mr. Donham.
Madam Chair, Representative Jessup, we have a very Minneapolis Public Schools has a very robust student placement, and we call it the school request system. So I had the fortune, good fortune, of actually helping build that system over the last 10 years. And the system allows parents to go in, not only get background about each of their school choices. So, for example, at a later day, I'll share with you the system, but you type in your address. You see all the school choices available to you for that particular grade level that have busing available to you, plus schools to which you don't get busing. The family then can compare both the descriptions of each of those schools as well as the data about the schools, their demographics, and test score results. And actually, one of the other pieces that is really important is the student survey and staff survey data that we provide. And I think that's a real, in addition to what Mr. Uni detailed, culture, how parents and students perceive a building, I think is really important. And that survey data is something that we share with parents so that they can make an informed decision.
So, Mr. Downham, you heard from two parents this morning who said that they need a system that is simpler so that when they look at, I think they were referring to the school report card, they know what it means for each school. So to what extent would a star rating system just complement the present report card? Mr. Dunn.
Madam Chair, good question. My sense is and Mr. Crossan made a very valid point. Some of the words that we use as part of our system aren't nearly as clear as they could be. I think putting a 0 or putting 1-4 system oversimplifies it. I think we were overcorrecting, frankly. And so, again, looking at this over the long term, coming up with terms that actually reflect the complexity of what's actually in MMR, and then the piece that I used a bad analogy, but I think the real issue is that we use a glass half empty MMR system. So a school is based on the parts that they miss as opposed to the parts that they make. So a school could miss or make all but one of their subgroup targets and still be considered a low-performing school. That's not to say we shouldn't be trying to hit every single one of those subgroup targets, but I'm afraid that when you put a very simple 1-4 system on top of something that measures the half full as opposed to half empty as a plus instead of half full, it makes it so simple that it glazes over the complexity.
Thank you, Mr. Downham. I believe Mr. Crossan, did you want to come forward and answer Representative Jessup's question? I'm sorry I interrupted you, Representative Jessup. Would you like to re-ask the question? Mr. Crossan, do you understand the question?
Madam Chair, would it be too much problem to re-ask the question?
No, absolutely, Madam Chair.
Representative Jessup.
Key question. You know, as we look at major decisions in life, one of the major decisions that as parents we're looking at is what school is going to be best for my child or my children. And so right now what I'm trying to get an understanding of is where do would I as a parent go to assess, let's hypothetically say, three elementary schools around me and be able to get a real clear understanding of what are the strengths and weaknesses of each of the schools? And am I going to get that clarity? Does that exist today?
Right.
Mr. Crossan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Jessup, that's a great question. I think I brought this bill up to a parent this morning asking what they thought about this legislation. And the response was, it reminds me kind of my Netflix account. Right? I have three-star, four-star, and five-star rated movies. That doesn't mean that I'm going to decide what I'm going to watch based on that Netflix star rating. I might read the summary. I might look into what my peers think about the movies. I might do my research and try to figure out if this is the one that's best fit for me. And I see something similar in this rating program. We're taking an overly complex accountability system and trying to make it understandable for parents. To Mr. Downing's point, I completely agree that our accountability system on the back end is not as entirely comprehensive as it should be. But whatever accountability system we do decide to choose should be clear and understandable and digestible for parents.
Representative Jessup, satisfied? Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Crossan. I believe the School Boards Association had a comment. Very briefly, please.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. As we reviewed this bill, and I have not had an opportunity to talk to Representative Peterson, there were two things that sort of came to our notice about it, and the first one being ESSA. We really feel there could be some big changes coming from the federal government down to us, and I know our state people continue to move forward. But with the change in administration, you might see a very large change in what they're expecting from us. So we want to give you some caution there. And I thought to myself, you know, I have been at the legislature a long time because I remember we did STARS at one point and decided that didn't work very well for us. And so we went on to numbers, and we've just sort of been through all the iterations. And everything that both sides have been saying is true. I just don't think we've found the magic sauce yet.
Thank you, Ms. Kelleher. Questions for the author? Representative Kunish Padin.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Peterson. I guess I'm coming to this, I'm looking at this as a parent. I had three children, and of course when it was time for me to decide where to send my kids, I did my homework and looked to see what was the best choice for them. But I'm also a public school teacher. And I know what public school teachers are up against, and I know that there's not always a favorable attitude towards our public school system and our teachers. There is hardly a teacher that I know whose heart was not in what was best for the student and how to educate that student. Mr. Jessup's analogy of buying a new car, that doesn't quite work when it comes to this because we're getting students from all sorts of different situations. You're trying to grade kids that come in the middle of the school year, don't speak the language that is, you know, they're ESL students, they might have certain disabilities. We have to meet those students where they are when we get them. And it doesn't always mean that we can bring them up to a certain level of expectation in a year, in a half a year. Sometimes those students need a lot of help, a lot of nurturing. And it might take them a while to do it. Rating the school by stars, not on performance, but on the growth, I think is really, it's unfair. It's unfair to the students. It's unfair to the families. It's unfair to those schools. Because I know that every teacher goes into that building every single day trying to figure out how I am going to reach every single one of those students. And we are doing our absolute best to do that. And when we are trying to compare ourselves, our public schools or the schools that are struggling the most with private schools, are we comparing them to charter schools? I guess one of my questions is, are all of these schools also going to be charted, scored by the this 1-4 star program as well? So I guess my two questions are we going to be basing these schools on performance or growth? And if you've ever been in a school where we've had testing, I mean, they're starting testing out. These kids are tested. They are so full of test fatigue, it's unbelievable. As a testing coordinator, that was probably one of the most heartbreaking, hardest jobs I ever had to do. Because by spring, all they're doing is sitting down in front of a computer and answering questions. And some of those questions are beyond their reach of understanding, their life experiences, their language, and that's how they're scored. It's like if I brought all of you in and had you take the MCA test for a fifth grader, you would be blown away by it.
Some of us have taken them.
Okay. And you know how hard it is. There are questions in there that absolutely boggle a fifth grader. You're an adult. You have life experiences, so maybe you can understand it. But we're talking about fifth graders coming from all different kinds of walks of life. I don't feel that this rating is in any way appropriate. I would not support it in any way, shape, and form. And so I guess, Representative Peterson, the two questions I have is, are we going to be basing these stars on performance rather than growth? And then is this going to be a broad-reaching performance score for charter schools, parochial schools, private schools, any of those sort of schools?
Representative Peterson.
Madam Chair, the short answer is yes and yes. So, as you know, schools are already under some form of evaluation, and the nice thing about ESSA is the Minnesota Department of Education will have a variety of measures that they will be looking at. So, for example, indicators including student growth, proficiency, language proficiency, graduation rates, and other indicators the state thinks it's important, such as absenteeism or school climate. Essentially, the accountability system should be comprehensive and indicative of the school's performance. And I guess that that's where we will, lean on the Minnesota Department of Education to make sure that we're looking at all the different components of what a school is. And, I mean, you're exactly right, Representative, where teachers are put in a tough position. There's a lot of different demographic differences between our schools across our state. There's a lot of different challenges. But unless we can identify which schools really need that extra help, they may never be able to live up to their highest potential. So, as Mr. Uni brought up, we need to make sure that the schools that aren't quite living up to where we would like those schools to be, that they have those additional resources. But we won't know unless we're able to basically do a variety of different assessments and figure out where these schools are and where they are not meeting where they need to be. So I hope that answers your question.
Representative.
So if we're going to use this as a way to assess the needs of a school, does that mean that eventually this will move into providing a base so that students or schools that are struggling or need the more help are going to be able to get more funding, get more assistance? Is this sort of like a pipeline to extra funding for schools?
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. Well, that's basically what's happening right now. So, I mean, if that's, the will of the legislature and the department, that will continue to be the practice.
Representative Pryor, last question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Peterson, a question that I have is, and I don't think this is a change, but I'm wondering if you had thought about this, that it's basically grading on a curve. So it's always saying there will be a one, because, you know, no matter how strong a performing school each one of these schools are, there will always be a one. And then as we say, you know, is that giving a parent good information to say relative to other ones there's always going to be somebody at the bottom? But it could be a high-performing school at some point if we do our jobs in the legislature and if we support, you know, if we support education, we could have high-performing schools. But we'll always tell parents, oh, your school's a one. So is that something that you had given thought to?
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Pryor. You know, thank you for bringing that up, because that's one thing I noticed as well. And so I guess I would encourage the Department of Education to also look at that and make sure that, you know, benchmarks or levels of proficiency are in there, because I think that you're right. You know, just because you're on a bell curve doesn't necessarily mean that that lower performing school is not doing a good job. So I guess that, however, if we're going to have resources dedicated to this type of assessment, then we want to make sure that those schools get the resources that they need. So I think that it can be a combination of both, and as always, I am open to working with all stakeholders on trying to make this legislation best, because ultimately we want to do what's best for kids.
Thank you, Representative Peterson. Closing comments.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. This has been a great discussion. I think that we've hit on every point that I would like, and I just ask for your support.
Thank you, Representative Peterson. The Chair renews her motion that House File 1966 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative Peterson.
Madam Chair.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Should we do the minutes from the previous meetings?
Yeah, we'll get to those.
Oh, yes.
You have an amendment for the amendment minutes?
Oh,
okay. Well, let's start with, let's see. Representative Ward, do you want to move the February 28 minutes?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I would like to amend those minutes, move that we amend them, because there's no adjournment time on the bottom. That's the only error that I saw. But I think we should add an adjournment time. And so with that amendment, I would move the minutes of February 28.
Representative Ward moves the minutes of February 28 with the amendment that an adjournment time be noted. I think you lost that when you were copying it. You have it there, but I think when he copied it, it's not on the back side. So thank you, Representative Ward. With that correction, all those in favor of the February 28 minutes as amended, technically, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails, and the minutes are approved as amended. Representative Bennett moves the minutes from March 2nd. Is there any discussion or additions or corrections? Hearing and seeing none, all those in favor of approval of the March 2nd minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails, and the minutes for March 2nd are approved. Members, I'm going to move to House File 877, which is authored by the Chair. I will move 877 for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Members, this is a recodification of a proposal that was placed in session law in both 2012 and 2014, and now my intention is to move it into the statute. There's a good description or a bill summary of it prepared by Ms. Pera that you can read about. It doesn't change anything. These are pilot projects. The commissioner still has a role to play, but it makes permanent these pilot projects, and it allows us to modify this now because it's in statute rather than in session law, which is always a good move if we want to massage something that we think is working really well. And innovation zones have proved to be very effective in our state, and we want to continue to promote that. So is there any discussion to House File 877? Hearing none, the Chair renews her motion that 877 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Thank you, members. Then we'll move to 1339. Representative Daniels, will you move 1339? This is assistive technology, so if the testifiers would be ready, I will introduce the bill. Whoops, I guess, Representative Daniels, you don't have to move it. It's my bill. Good grief. But I know I had wanted you to carry it. That's why I said your name. That chair moves House File 1339 for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Welcome to the table. Members, 1339 is the use of transformative assistive technology that is used in our special education programs. There's a little caveat in this proposal so that there's more of a linkage to the improvement plan for our children. We're going to have a good discussion today. I don't want this addition, if we include it in the omnibus bill, to be a burden for our special education teachers by way of paperwork. So we will listen to the discussion today and make some decisions. But this is really important technology in many ways for our special education students that perhaps our school teachers are not in special education, not using as readily as maybe they should. So we'll listen to this discussion. So members, I would like to turn over to my testifiers from PACE. First of all, I believe you represent the Simon Technology Center. So please say your name for the record and begin.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for having me here today. My name is Bridget Gilermini, and I am director of the Simon Technology Center at PACER and a former special educator. PACER Center is a statewide organization for parents of children and youth with all disabilities. Through individual consultations, trainings, and our lending library, we help children access assistive technology they need to be more successful and independent at school, home, and in the community. Assistive technology includes a range of low-tech and high-tech devices, such as adaptive keyboards, apps and software that help students who have trouble speaking or reading or writing, and telepresence robots that enable students with immune deficiency to attend school with their peers. I brought some examples here to show you at the end of my testimony. Assistive technology is a powerful tool to help students with disabilities of all ages to be more successful. It matters. However, even though the need for assistive technology is required to be considered as part of the individual education program or IEP process, it is frequently overlooked and underdocumented, especially with young children. PACER currently has a project working with young children in early childhood programs in Bloomington, Anoka-Hennepin, and Rosemont, Eagan, Apple Valley school districts. And through this project, we've discovered an underdocumentation of the use of assistive technology with young children that could help them. And I have many stories from the work I do in our center about the difference assistive technology has made in the lives of children with disabilities, such as the little girl who used a communication device to tell her mother, "I love you," for the first time, or the teen with cancer who attended our science camp through a telepresence robot, or the child who used her toe to touch a switch and play with a toy, which was the first time she had ever done something on her own. This bill would ensure that IEP teams more intentionally consider whether assistive technology is needed and to document their decision. Through the project I mentioned earlier, we developed and piloted a simple, easy-to-use tool that teachers found very helpful and easy to use. It is heart-wrenching in the work that I do to see the number of students who come through my center at an older age and for the first time experience life-changing technology that they should have had exposure to years prior. By ensuring more students with disabilities have access to the assistive technology they need beginning at an early age, we will support students' academic achievement and future successes in college and the workforce. And then some of the technology that I brought you, our lending library has approximately 1,500 pieces of assistive technology, which is just a range of the items that are available. So the things I brought represent that range, from very simple pencil grips that help a child write and compose, to fidgets that help children who have their bodies need to move and fidget while they're learning. So very simple, very inexpensive, to pens that don't look any different from any other pens we might see in a classroom, that have a camera and a recording device, that allows a student who has difficulty with organization and memory to capture what the teacher is saying, write them down in a notebook, and be able to reference them later. So the student, like me, who had to write down everything to remember what the teacher said and then remembered nothing, I have a tool now that I can use that can help me. To our mobile and tablet technology that has apps and programs that allow us in my hand and with very little cost to access tools that help me to read and write and learn. And then our telepresence robot, I'm not going to be able to drive him over here.
Thank you very much.
But he allows us to be in the classroom and put the experience of the learning in the hands of the child, and it may not show up because of Wi-Fi, but allows them that very important and critical socialization piece at school. Thank you.
So does PACER have any idea to what extent these devices are used across the state in our programs?
We loan out and have memberships with parents and districts and professionals across the state. I have numbers, not off the top of my head. But the purpose of our lending library is to give parents and professionals an opportunity to try these things as part of that consideration process before making purchasing decisions.
And then, Ms. Is it Jill or Gil?
Jill
Armini. To what extent do teachers have to record the use of those devices in any of their reports that they or plans that they prepare?
And that's part of the consideration process. So at every annual, at every IEP or IFSP meeting, teachers are required to consider assistive technology. Throughout the span of that year, as the needs of the child changes, as different technologies become available, then we might revisit the conversation. Doesn't necessarily mean another formal meeting, but we would revisit the conversation and assess the needs. Does that answer your question, Madam?
So, Ms. Gilarmini, do they have to then reopen the special ed report or plan to incorporate that so they're going to have more paperwork? Could you answer that, please?
No, ma'am. They could write the inclusion of that assistive technology in a progress report. It could go into an evaluation report. It could be documented at the next annual IEP meeting. It could be in the notes, the parent notes that they communicate. So they can if the team decides, if it's a team decision that they want to meet again, but they don't have to.
Because I did visit with special education teachers just in the last day who expressed to me that this would be more paperwork for them because they could have to reopen the reports, and we want to ensure that we are not burdening those hardworking teachers, and I know how difficult it is to take on, our special needs programs because they cover such a comprehensive area to meet the needs of those children. So, we want to make sure we balance it.
And that's a great point, Madam Chair. And as a former teacher, I totally understand the, and that was actually one of my concerns in teaching was the amount of paperwork that I was doing. So in the design of the plan, that's absolutely something we worked with the teachers who piloted it, and we knew it had to be simple, easy to use, and it had to fit in with the processes and the systems that they were already doing so that it was not perceived as additional paperwork.
Thank you very much. We also have Kathy Graves, who's a parent of a student who's using assistive technology. And it is so nice to have a parent here who's had experience with this. Welcome to our committee. And say your name for the record, and please tell us about this experience.
My name is Kathy Graves, and I am the mother of Sam Graves, who I wish he could be here today, but he has his first job, and he's not going to take off time. He is now 23. He just graduated last spring from Augsburg College with highest honors. He also has cerebral palsy and uses a wheelchair and needs a lot of physical accommodations for his learning. And as a mother, I'm a veteran of dozens of IEP meetings, and I'm the daughter of a teacher, and my oldest son is a teacher, so I understand well the burdens of special education sometimes in paperwork. But I'm here to testify today about assistive technology. It has been completely transformative and really powerful for Sammy. It has improved his learning. It is reduced, especially when we've seen it used really well in college, completely reduces the need for labor or aides, educational assistance, and increases his independence, and really importantly, assistive technology can improve employability, as I've seen with Sam. The assistive technology has let him leveled some playing fields, and now he has a job. And as you probably know, Minnesota does not have particularly good numbers in terms of employment figures for people with disabilities. Assistive technology can be a huge help in that. Sam used lots of his assistive technology over the years, Kurzweil, an e-reader. He used the smart pen she showed. He used a very simple 99-cent app called Audio Note that completely changed his life. Sam had the benefit of being an early adopter through Pacer. He went to a workshop when he was 3. We had no idea what we were doing, but he learned to use a tracking ball. That was an old-fashioned thing now, but we use a lot of technology through Pacer, but we frequently had to be the teacher of this to the district. We had to constantly bring it to the district instead of the other way around. So it really is not a very equitable way of assistive technology being delivered. So I would encourage you to consider strengthening this, because it is a really, we have this technology, we should be using it, and it should not add to the paperwork. This just should be a simple, natural thing that schools do. And I wanted to add one thing, is that Sam, through his work, he's now just gotten appointed to the Minnesota Assistive Technology Citizen Advisory Council. So thank you very much.
Will you stay at the table, please, and Ms. Jill Armini, will you come back, because I think Representative Pryor had a question, and Representative Bly as well. So we'll lead off with Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is probably a question for the author. So it's talking about including assisted technology in the plan, but then, you know, can school districts afford the technology? And is that, where does that come into this? Because some of them, I understand the stuffed animal would be affordable, but then maybe some of this other technology, is adding to the cost.
Representative Pryor, that's a really good question, and I did ask Dr. Melcher what he testified in our finance committee about the cost. Was it included in the funding that we provide for our different levels in special needs? And he said it was, but we're going to hear from the School Boards Association and from the department. They may comment on whether or not they think that is actually included, but that's what Dr. Melcher said, that funding did include. Representative Bly, do you have a question for the testifiers?
I do. Thank
Please,
you.
Yes,
Chair.
Go ahead.
And to the author, I thank you for bringing the bill forward. I am a co-author on the bill.
I saw that. Thank you.
I think it's an important issue that should deal with. I also met with teachers who talked with me about the, and having been a special ed teacher myself, I know that the paperwork is an issue, and it's, and they wondered a couple of things. One was, I know the department is working on the possibility of a statewide kind of format, and hopefully that would be something that could include this kind of part of the plan. And the teachers wondered if a checklist would suffice, so that, you know, you could show that this was brought up and was talked about. And would that, if there was no need at that particular time, would that suffice in meeting the demand for a plan, rather than having to make a plan for every student, whether or not that's needed? I just wanted to get some clarity about, because I think that the call for a plan is a little bit ambiguous. It's not clear exactly what is being looked for. So kind of looking for a way to show that this was talked about, but not necessarily demanding a plan for every student.
Ms. Jill Armini.
The plan actually goes through the four possible outcomes of consideration. And so there is no checklist, but it documents the conversations and the hopes of making the process much more intentional and seeing increases in the documentation of assistive technology. And I think it's a little bit dangerous when we start going with checklists, because checklists aren't necessarily all-encompassing. And if I don't know about the things that might not be on that checklist, some of the very important technology might be missed, if that makes sense.
Representative Bly?
I think so, although, I think what, thank you, Chair, but I think that what the these teachers were concerned about was being able to show that they did have a conversation about it without having to, you know, go deeply into the plan. So, hopefully that would be something that can be considered. I know this will be held over for possible inclusion, so hopefully the author can work with you about how to best describe that and make sure that teachers do have some way of avoiding the in-depth sort of plan when it may not be necessary. I understand there are times when it might be necessary and something could be missed, and we want to make sure that we deal with that. So just for your consideration.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Bly, and I assure you I'm going to continue to work with them because I really do think this is so important to our children. But I, again, as I said at the outset, I do not want to add paperwork to our already overburdened special education teachers. Representative Grassel.
Madam Chair, thank you. And that's one of the questions that I had because the special ed teachers that have come to visit, that is a big problem for them, the piles of paperwork that have to be done, and it keeps them from spending valuable time with the students. So I understand that there is something that was put in place last year.
Yes.
Is
reduction in paperwork?
Are they moving forward on that? As I guess who would that question be best for?
Well, I think Representative Grasso will eventually ask the department to comment on that, but probably not at this time. Representative Kunesh Padin, question.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Armani, is that it?
Gilamini, sorry.
Are you finding that special ed teachers or teachers that are dealing with students with disability are not looking into these different options for assistive technology?
They're either not.
Ms. Gilamini, yes, are they not? I mean, is there a reason that this has to be legislated? That's the question.
Yes, thank you. So we know that the process of consideration is a legal mandate. We're required to do that for every IEP, but we're finding that it's either not being done or it's under-documented. They're doing it. They're having those conversations, but there isn't any evidence of it in their documentation or paperwork. And then that leads to not good communication between parents and teachers and not necessarily good outcomes for kids.
Representative. Thank you. So I'm a library media specialist, and I do I spent 20 years in the elementary level teaching technology skills to kids, and I did a lot of work with students with disability, and it was one of probably some of the most rewarding work that I've done. I'm at the middle school now, and I have students with the eye recognition, and it just, like, opened up their world, and it's just the most utterly fabulous thing to watch. So I really support making sure that all of our students have those tools and those opportunities to learn and open up their own world, and especially in the form of communication with family and other people. The one question, again, as with Representative Pryor, is the cost of this. You said PACER loans out these different items that families and schools can use in their district. Is that right?
Mr. Larmini.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes. We loan them out to the entire state of Minnesota. So we mail items out to our members, and then they mail items back to us. And they have them for up to a month. And if needed, sometimes they can have them for 2 months. Sometimes we long-term loan those items because they are more expensive, like our telepresence robots, because we understand about navigating that cost sometimes. We want to make as much technology as available and increase awareness and understanding to as many parents and professionals that we can.
Thank you, and thank you for your testimony.
And just one more question. So are there grants, is there funding that helps families and schools to purchase this, or where is the burden of the financial responsibility?
Ms. Gilamini.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Representative, when some of the equipment is identified as medical necessity, then districts and families can access third-party billing and insurance for things like communication devices and medical equipment that's deemed medically necessary. For other equipment, sometimes county waiver programs can come in and help support that, and then other times we need to be creative with funding. And that is probably the most frequently question that we get asked from our parents is, how can we fund technology that isn't necessarily identified as a need, but we think it would be really beneficial for our child?
Ms. Graves.
I wanted to say one thing is also in the fast-paced change of technology, when Sammy first started out and needed, he has some difficulty being understood language-wise, and communication devices were like $5,000, $7,000. But with the advent of the iPad, it has changed that dramatically. So some of the costs, like I said, audio note, which can record and can, it's like a kind of verbal highlighting of lectures, was 99 cents. So not everything is, I mean, especially with the iPad, it's introduced incredible cost savings into the whole world of assistive technology.
Thank you, both of you. I'd like to call forward now the manager of the Deaf, Hard, and of Hearing and Blind Visually Impaired Services to express, I am sure, both support and concern because this community needs a special kind of assistive technology, and they want to demonstrate that for us. Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
My name is Jay Furman. I'm a principal and manager of Deaf and Hard of Hearing, Deaf and Hard of Hearing, Deaf Blind Visually Impaired Programs at Northeast Metro 9-15.
And we're very happy to have you.
Thank you. It is an honor to be here with you today. My name is Jay Furman. I work for Northeast Metro Intermediate School District 9-15, serving 14 school districts north and east of a metro area. As a principal, I oversee staff who work with students who are deaf, hard of hearing, deaf, blind, and blind visually impaired. More specifically, my deaf and hard of hearing teaching staff serves over 250 students who are deaf and hard of hearing from kindergarten through grade 12. Deaf and hard of hearing is best described as a disability of actor. Since the use of technology is prevalent in our society and education, there has been a shift in instructional strategy used by general education teachers called flipped instruction. What that means is that a teacher would make a short video, usually 5 to 10 minutes of a lesson for the student to view at home before the next day's lesson. It also allows the student to view the lesson multiple times to learn the concept. Those teacher-created videos are not captioned. Therefore, the deaf and hard of hearing students are expected to view non-captioned videos and be prepared to learn the next day. The non-captioned videos are unacceptable and have created additional barriers for deaf and hard of hearing students. I can also speak from a personal experience as a deaf parent of hearing children. My children have had flipped instruction. However, those videos are not acceptable to me, making it difficult for me to help my own children with homework. This is 2017, and we can do better than maintaining the status quo of passive ignorance to a widespread problem of inaccessibility. I'm asking you to consider adding a language to the Child Centered Assistive Technology Plan to include equipment or auxiliary aid services such as closed captioning on teacher-created video. Thank you.
Mr. Furman. We understand what you're saying. And now I think we're going to watch a video, is that correct, that shows the closed caption need for our students.
Right. It will show, Madam Chair and Representative, it will show that what the deaf and hard of hearing students actually hear in the video without captions.
Yes. Oh, yes.
So it'll go
Thank
both
you.
Ways.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. It was set up before to show on the screens, and now it seems to have disconnected.
Pages, do you have any expertise in this area? He's going to get Bill. We'll get our tech expert. He's just around the corner. Well, are you close, do you think? Because we could call up Grace Kelleher from the Minnesota School Boards Association.
I see that you can see all my files, but...
Hey, just could you provide for another chair for Ms. Kelleher?
I must be ready.
Oh, okay. Thank you. I guess we're going to just vacate for a second here. Welcome, Ms. Kelleher. I know you have some concerns from the School Boards Association, so please say your name and begin.
Good morning, Madam Chairman and members. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. As we went through this document or this bill, we had a couple of concerns, and one has already been addressed, the idea of having a plan. A plan isn't a checklist, but it would include something like we'd have to test the child to find out where they are, make a plan, measure the results, and address behavioral concerns and include other certain basic skills going forward. So to us, that's what that word means in this statute. And if it really is something else we need going forward, I think the first testifier said something very clear to me is that it is already in law that the teams are supposed to do this as they're going through the plan. And I think there's some frustration with, you know, you all do the statutes around here. I'm not sure putting it in more is going to get you necessarily a different result going forward. With that, we are also really concerned about the paperwork burden facing special education teachers. So, Madam Chair, you hit on that. So that wraps up a couple of our concerns.
Thank you. We'll continue to work on this. Thank you very much. The department, until they have it ready, would you come forward? Mr. Uni, if you have some information to share with us about the concerns from MDE, welcome. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Madam Chair, members, again, my name is Adosh Uni, Director of Government Relations at the Department of Education. Much of what we've said, or much of what has been said, is kind of covered in my testimony, but I'll just repeat very quickly. So just wanted to caution the committee, again, just to be aware that under IDEA, this already requires consideration of the assistive technology for all within an IEP, as well as with four other special considerations. But IDEA doesn't mandate a specific protocol or process for considering the factor, as this bill may. So what IDEA does mandate is that if the team determines one of those specific supports under those special considerations is needed, that the IEP will include it. And MDE provides assistance on the consideration, the documentation, and implementation of the assistive technology in an IEP, but we haven't chosen to mandate a specific protocol since that would exceed the requirements of IDEA. So it's just important to note that this could, as was brought up by the chair and other testifiers, and I think recognized that this could be resultant by the supporters, that it could result in an extra paperwork burden. And this would kind of be a little bit in conflict with so much which members have been focused on, I think, resulting in a question about the paperwork reduction efforts over the past few years from the legislature, as well as a lot of questions members have had this year in this committee and other committees. And this just could also set a precedent for setting protocol for the other special factors as well, which quite possibly could result in more paperwork. So we just want members to be aware. Madam Chair, would you like me to discuss at all the paperwork reduction efforts? I can do that briefly, or I can wait until after this presentation.
Do it briefly right now.
Just to note, Representative, we did present in House Finance on this. We had several presentations on special education and special education paperwork reduction. One of the large efforts that we've been doing is reducing the state requirements that are attached to our federal responsibilities. So on our program monitoring under Part B and Part C documents, we've had there's the requirement of document reviews and citations. And between 2015-16 year and the 16-17 year, we've had a reduction in the documents reviewed of 30%, so from around 35 pages to 20,000 pages, and citations that they've had to review about a 43% reduction between that year and this year. So we are well on our way to reducing paperwork in special education, but I know the efforts are ongoing as well.
Thank you, Mr. Ernie. Now we're ready for the access to closed captioning in the classroom.
process of bombing incidents just a moment, and often students are involved in being the bomb laser student in the entire school with a hearing loss.
Thank you very much. So, Mr. Furman, would you comment then on what we've just seen and how we need to consider that in this proposal, House File 1339?
Madam Chair and Representative, I'm happy to explain what I'm trying to point out from the video. And as a person that needed hearing aid, and we have a number of students that need cochlear implants, many people make the false assumption that just because we have, you know, hearing, we can understand everything. And when you come to comprehension, that's a whole different ballgame. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes I can't comprehend other people without lip reading, without sign language. And oftentimes in the classroom, general ed teachers would show short clips from YouTube or other videos. And they don't think about if they were captioned or not. And oftentimes they forget about us, and they show the video, and then we don't have actor. And that becomes a problem. And they often forget about making the videos that they create acceptable as well. And with the number of students I served, that has become a problem. And even as a deaf person myself, all the content online, you know, you go through Facebook, you go through all the social media, many videos are not captioned. So I don't have access to the same information as everyone else.
Thank you, Mr. Furman. And we'll consider this if we place this in a possible omnibus bill. So thank you very much, members. I'll give closing comments for House File 1339. I think assistive technology is obviously an asset to our students, but we have some issues we need to work out with both the supporters and those concerned, and I will continue to work with them if we include this provision. So, members, with that, the chair renews her motion that House File 1339 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Lee. Welcome to the testifying table. And because you're the author of this, you'll have the pleasure and the honor to move your own bill, and that's so great. And you have an amendment that you're going to want to offer. So why don't you say your name for the record? Oh, my goodness, we have treats.
Madam Chair, State Representative Foley.
All for the chair, of course. So, Representative Lee, you will need to introduce yourself and then move your file and then move your amendment. And this is for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. So, please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, State Representative Fu Lee. I want to move House File 1426 before the committee to be considered for possible inclusion in the education omnibus bill.
Very good. And then your A1 amendment.
So the A1 amendment just provides clarifying language to define what race is, and those are the seven categories that are used by the federal government.
Thank you very much. Representative Lee moves the A1 amendment. Is there further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye. Aye. Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted, and your bill is in the order that you'd like it. Please proceed to explain this to us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So House File 1426 adds a simple but key provision to help identify what's working in our teacher preparations programs as it relates to graduating teachers of colors. Mm-hmm. And the bill will require the teacher report card, which was passed in 2015, to disaggregate certain outcomes by race in order to inform us and prospective teachers, teacher candidates, about which institutions are working to, and which institutions are committed to helping our teachers of color or candidates who want to get into the profession. And right now, we currently aren't able to see how many candidates of color are coming out of different institutions. And this data will be great for providing some kind of feedback for our candidates with regards to their satisfaction with the programs. And also just want to point out that this bill do have some clarifying language in there to protect the privacies of individuals for people who are concerned with that. And to wrap up my introductory remark, I do think that if we're serious as a body about teacher diversity, we should start looking at how we could encourage more or help more candidates of colors get into the profession. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to my customer.
Thank you, Representative Lee. Very well explained. Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Madeline Edison, and I'm the Executive Director of Educators for Excellence Minnesota, which is a nonprofit organization that works to ensure that educators have a leading voice in policy decisions that impact their students and their profession. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in favor of House File 1426, a bill that amends the Teacher Prep Report Card bill that this body passed into law 2 years ago. So I'd like to give a little bit of background on where that bill originated and why this amendment really matters. And then I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Amira C. Guy, who is going to talk about why this matters to her as an inspiring educator. And she is a Capital Pathways Fellow with E4E this year. So two years ago, teachers organized through E4E to write up a number of policy recommendations on increasing the quality and diversity of the teacher workforce in our state. One of their recommendations was that they believe prospective teachers, like other professionals, should have access to information that would help them choose the right preparation institution for them. So they proposed crafting a teacher prep report card, is what we called it, that would have all teacher prep institutions in the state report on a common set of outcomes, including licensure rates, job placement rates, satisfaction rates, and then later on the effectiveness of those teachers once in the classroom. And with the support of many of you here today, including Chief Author Representative Erdahl, we passed that bill into law, and so next summer we'll see the outcome of that push with the state's first teacher prep report card. This year, our teachers came together identifying the need to continue working on that bill to ensure that those certain outcomes could be desegregated by race so that future teachers of color could see which institutions are effectively serving future teachers of color or not. And because the legislature has identified increasing teacher diversity as a top priority, our teachers think that desegregating this data would serve as a tool for policymakers to replicate and hold up what's working well. And lastly, they think this data could help teacher preparation programs as well so that they can learn from each other. So we're here today to propose a small amendment to the report card that will benefit future teachers of color and think it's a common sense proposal that won't cost anything extra but will impact the lives of future teachers. So I'll turn it over to Amira to share more about her personal story and why it matters to her.
Thank you, Ms. Edison, and welcome, Ms. Teasgay, to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Amira Sagai, and I'm a Capital Pathways intern with Educators for Excellence. I'm currently a sophomore at Minneapolis Community and Technical College, and I'm an aspiring teacher. So as we all know, there's a lack of teachers of color in Minnesota, so having this data disaggregated by race can make the process of looking for a preparation program easier for aspiring teachers of color such as myself. I plan on transferring to the University of Minnesota in the fall, and soon I'll have to begin looking for a teacher preparation program myself. During this internship, and a lot, I've done some research on prep programs in the state, and a lot of these programs, including the U of M's, had no diversity percentages, no reports on students of color, and no completion or retention rates. So it'd be beneficial if more of them had disaggregated data so I can figure out which ones will help me the most. QFUN programs such as the East African Student to Teacher program at Augsburg has done a good job in doing this, but it would be helpful if more schools outside of these programs had this data available. And I've been looking at some of the summaries of teacher prep reports, and it's been frustrating at times because of the lack of information that they had. So I want to find a program that I know has served people of color well, a program that I know will serve me well as a
candidate of color and will be a pathway for success in my career as a teacher. And growing up, I've had very few teachers of color, but the ones I've had, I've cherished. Shout out to my ninth grade algebra teacher, Ms. Alavari from South High School. I want to make those same connections with students myself and make that difference in other kids' lives. This is why this bill is important to me and why having data desegregated by race will make this process a lot easier for me and other student teachers of color. And I ask you for your support in this bill, and I thank you again, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for allowing me to testify.
Thank you very much for your testimony, and we look forward to you joining the ranks of the profession of education and being one of our great teachers. Very good. Members, are there questions for the author or for the testifiers? Representative Lee, I thank you for bringing this forward. This will be, as Ms. Edison pointed out, a great addition to legislation that Representative Erdahl did get enacted in the last couple of years, and the report, as she said, is now going to start making sense, and it'll be even more specific with this addition. So closing comments, please, Representative Lee.
Madam Chair, I want to say thank you to my co-authors for supporting me with this bill, Chair Erdahl, Chair Erickson, Chair Loon, and Representative Ward for helping me with this, and I look forward to working with other members, too.
And would you say a bit about the treats, because I know they were special.
So these...
Get credit where credit's due.
These croissants are from Chuan Nung French Bakery, which is down the University Avenue over by Dill over there. And just wanted to bring this by for all community members. And thank you for not asking me the tough questions.
Yes, and they look spectacular. We can maybe have them for lunch. Thank you very much, Representative Lee. And the chair lays over House File 1426 for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Thank you very much, and thank you, testifiers. Members, we're going to move to the proposal that deals with the Purpich Center for Arts Education, or Purpich Arts High School. Representative Loon cannot join us for a few more minutes, so I will unofficially move House File 1825 and ask the Office of Legislative Auditor, Ms. Randall, and anyone who would like to assist her in giving us a brief overview of what the Legislative Auditor's report revealed about both the Purpich Center for Arts Education and its program side, its evaluation side, and its conveyance of crosswinds, which occurred 3 years ago. Welcome, Ms. Randall, to the committee. And please say your name for the record and tell us which report you'll begin with.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is Judy Randall. I'm the Deputy Legislative Auditor for OLA's Program Evaluation Division. And I know Mr. Nobles and Mr. Alter, who's the Program Evaluation Manager on this evaluation, just walking.
He's joining us, yes.
So, good timing. I think what I'll do is just start to do a little overview of both reports, and then Mr. Alter will be here to answer more specific questions related to our evaluation.
And Ms. Randall, if I may interrupt you, members, you know, we've heard these reports before, but we know we have persons in the audience who perhaps are not aware of some of the detail that is included in both of these reports. So with that, I asked the Office of the Legislative Auditor to just give us a brief overview. Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, as you just noted, we released this report, these two reports, 6 weeks ago to this committee. And if you recall, we found a lot of problems. We had some really significant findings in both reports. I'll start just by talking briefly about the financial audit report, which is the smaller of the two, and it has a light blue cover. And really the key point there is that through this audit and, frankly, several other previous audits, we have found recurring financial management problems at Purpich Center for Arts Education. In this most recent audit, we found that the center failed to resolve four prior audit findings, and we had a significant finding that the agency did not adequately, I'm just going to read from it to get the correct financial audit terminology, it did not adequately assess its financial risks or monitor the effectiveness of its internal controls. In financial audit speak, those are strong findings. No, it may not sound like that in normal conversation, but it was a strong financial audit with, again, persistent concerns. Related to the program evaluation, we found concerns related to oversight, management, operations, and as you may recall, we set forth in the report four options for the legislature to consider to address and help resolve the concerns that we identified. And one of those options for the legislature to consider, option number four, was to eliminate the Purpich Center, which I believe is what is contained in the bill you're considering today. It was, you know, fourth out of four, so it's at one end of the spectrum of options, but we do think that there were significant problems and they require a significant response. I will note that right now the Purpich Center has a new interim executive director and a largely new board. Most of the board members are new. So it's a new group of people who are in place to address the findings that we found. Whether or not this is the right team, you know, I don't know, and you don't know yet. And so I think that's something for you all to consider of if you think this is the right team in place to be able to address the concerns that we've identified without dissolving the center completely. But I will note that, again, we did have serious concerns and that the bill does contain provisions related to one of the options we outlined. Now, as you may recall, the Purpich Center has three really key sets of responsibilities. One is it operates the Arts High School in Golden Valley, which is a residential or commuter arts high school for 11th and 12th graders. It operates Crosswinds, which is in Woodbury, and it's a 6th through 10 middle school. And then it conducts arts education outreach statewide. So my understanding of the bill as it's been introduced is that it would move some of the arts education outreach responsibility to the Department of Education. And I'll let others speak to the conversations that are happening regarding Crosswinds, but my understanding is that the St. Paul School District has been in conversations with the Purpich Board to perhaps convey responsibility for Crosswinds to that school district. So between the bill and those actions, two of those three ongoing responsibilities of Purpich Center would be, you know, in some form continued. The Arts High School would not be, is, again, my understanding of the lay of the land currently. So that's kind of the 10,000-foot overview. I know Mr. Alter is here to answer specific questions or add any commentary if he has some. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Randall. Welcome, Mr. Alter. Will you please say your name for the record, and then I have some questions for you.
Madam Chair, my name is Joel Alter with the Legislative Auditor's Office.
So, members, in the program evaluation, which is the larger report, Mr. Alter, beginning on page 4, you know, when the legislature created this agency, and this, members, is an agency, I found that it was a rather broad statement made by the legislature back in the late 80s to create this. So in your evaluation or the steps that you took to evaluate the program, what did you find in regard to the legislative statement as well as the mission of Purpich, which is, I think, spelled out for us on pages 4 and 5? Please proceed.
Madam Chair, when the Purpich Center was created, there were really two very closely tied goals that legislators had for the Purpich Center. Mm-hmm. There had been some discussions about whether to create a standalone arts high school. There was a lot of debate about that, and there was some discussion in the legislature about whether that was elitist, whether that was something that would provide opportunities for students that they couldn't get in their home districts. But I think that what really cemented the proposal and provided support in the legislature was the notion that this would not only be for that group of 300 or so students who would come to the Twin Cities and study at an arts high school, but that the Purpich Center would also provide statewide support to school districts. That combination of an arts high school and statewide support for arts education were what really, I think, provided the impetus for this organization to go forward. That isn't spelled out in a real clear mission statement in statute, but that certainly is consistent with the mission that the Perpetrator Center has identified for itself going forward.
And members, just to remind you that at the top of page 5, there is a very broad mission from Perpich in that this was to provide an opportunity to develop and integrate artistic and academic abilities for all Minnesota students. And so as the report has revealed, we have not been addressing all students in that the outreach program has not proceeded as it should, according to what we expected of Perpich, and secondly, that we've not had students come from all congressional districts to enroll. In fact, Mr. Alter, will you comment on what has happened with the enrollment over the last few years, or Ms. Randall?
Madam Chair, regarding enrollment at the Arts High School, two things to take note of. One is that there has been a decline in the overall enrollment. There is a cap in state statute of 310 students for the Arts High School. Only you go back to 2011, and the school was pretty close to that cap on the first day of school. I believe the first day enrollment this year was more in the neighborhood of 180-something. So there has been a significant drop in the overall enrollment at the Perpich High School. But the other thing to note is that when the Arts High School was created, there was, I think, a greater balance in terms of where the students are coming from. Today, about 80% of the students are from the Twin Cities area. We noted in the report, it's a little bit murky in the statutes as to whether the statutes require there to be balance among the congressional districts in the enrollment at the school. But there's one congressional district which accounts for most of western Minnesota that does not have any students at the Arts High School currently. So those are the two key trends I think to be aware of regarding enrollment.
And Mr. Alter, I also noticed that the school has primarily female students, and if you compare that across the state, 79% are female, 49% in the state in our schools are female. And then when we look at racial or ethnic minorities, it is also low there, or lower than the statewide, at 20% versus 27% statewide. And Crosswinds, of course, has a very, I think, commendable racial and minority balance in having 61% of their students. I also wanted you to comment on the organization of the board and the executive directors and some of that history.
Sure. Madam Chair, the governing body for the Perpich Center is a board of directors. It's established in statute. There are 15 members of the board. They are appointed by the governor. They serve four-year terms and can be reappointed. There is also an executive director, and that position is established in statute. As Ms. Randall said, there has been a lot of turnover on the board of directors. The executive director, there was the same executive director from 2010, the beginning of 2010, until the very beginning of this year. That person resigned, and as Ms. Randall said, there's now an interim executive director. We think there have been issues with leadership at the Perpich Center. We looked at, in particular, the board of directors and noted many instances in which they weren't following their own bylaws, policies, but also I think just the level of activity of the board was not what you would expect for a board, particularly that operates two schools. So we thought that very much so the board had to kind of get its act together to become more active, to look at its own policies, follow them. If they're not appropriate, amend them. I do think that certainly the new board chair has kind of a reform agenda and wants to see that the board gets back on track as well as the agency as a whole. But again, we have a lot of new board members and a lot of work to do.
Thank you, Mr. Alter. And it's a large board for a board that supports a small agency. And I also, I think, am aware that in most small agencies, the governor appoints
the executive director rather than the board hiring. So I think with that, we're going to call a halt to the input you're giving because the author of our bill is here now. Welcome, Representative Loon, Chair Loon, to the testifying table. And members, I will officially move House File 1825 to be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. Representative Loon, welcome to our committee. I know how busy you are this morning, and we really appreciate you taking time. I think you have an hour that you can spend with us at the most, so thank you. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Jennifer Loon, State Representative from Eden Prairie, and I appreciate the opportunity to be before the committee to have a discussion about the Purpich Center and its future. And unfortunately, I was in a meeting and didn't hear all of the testimony that was provided just now from the Legislative Auditor's Report, but I know from previous hearing you've had and the Committee on Education Finance has had is that it's certainly a very sobering report, some very concerning facts and hard facts about sort of management and that's been going on with Purpich. And these problems are not new. When I was looking into this a little deeper and going back to see what's been happening since the Purpich Center and the Arts High School was created, this is not the only report that has raised questions. The legislative auditor has audits going back, and I've got a stack of them. And many problems have been identified repeatedly in those reports and not corrected. So I want to choose my words here very carefully because I am a strong proponent of the arts. Our family is, and I think making sure that our children have exposure to the arts and those opportunities to pursue their creative talents is incredibly important and a vital part of our education of them and should be integrated into our education system for all of our children. I feel very, very strongly about that. But as I look at how the Purpich Center was created and the thought around it, I just don't feel it was crafted in a method that really destined it for success. And again, with the information that's come forward, I think it's very clear that it hasn't necessarily been that way. There have been some bright spots in some of the outreach to arts teachers in the arts across our schools in the past, but a lot of that mission as it was laid out when the concept was first created has really not been fulfilled. I think it perhaps hasn't had as clear a mission. There isn't really a mission or a purpose statement in the authorizing legislation from back in the 80s. And with all of the changes that have occurred in our educational system, the operation of a school, which was a really innovative and interesting approach at the time, since those days, we have had the charter school law that has been authorized, allowing for the growth of schools, public schools, to be created, providing different emphasis for children, sciences, STEM, the arts, other things. I think there may be a better way to get at the purpose of making sure that children have the opportunities to pursue their passions and their creative abilities in a way that is not necessarily a separate state agency, an agency that was created very uniquely in having a board that had really all authority over the school. We don't have, I think there's only two other agencies that exist in that manner. So, while this may seem harsh to some, I think it's a conversation and a proposal that needs to be put on the table for discussion and for consideration.
Thank you, Representative Loon. Would you like to cover the fiscal on page 9 of the program report, comment on the kinds of funds that we provide and then the other sources of revenue for Purpich?
Yes, Madam Chair. There is a general fund appropriation that is made as part of the education finance budget every biennium for the Purpich Center. And so if members have a copy of the report for 2015-16, so the current most recent information that is in the report, it's 6.7, I'll just round up, $6.7 million in 2015, $6.872 in 2016, general appropriations to the Purpich Center. There's additional money that goes in state and federal aid, and that's mostly for the operation of the Craftsman School, and it's $2,291,745 in 2015, $2,144,644 in 2016. There are also appropriations or grants from the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. So the, as people will remember, the sales tax money that was dedicated, there are some funds that go from those appropriations. There are student fees. So their students do have to pay certain fees to attend the Purpich High School. Excuse me. Whether they are may live in the dormitory, there's fees for that. Certain student activities fees and others that are covered, and those are incorporated in that line. Again, other education aid that goes specifically to the high school. The other line was for Crosswinds. $100,000 in 15 and a very small amount in 16, $1,814. There are grants that may come from other agencies and outside entities, about $15,000 in 2015, $41,000 in 2016, and then gifts and donations that may come from alumni, supporters, and that, a little over $5,000 in 2015 and $6,700 in 2016. So overall, budget for Purpich is, in round figures, about $10.5 million each year. And so,
so, Madam Chair, what does that equal for per student?
Well, you know, in looking at the per student expenditures for Purpich and then for Crosswinds, you know, not all of the money that is in the figures that I went through are for the operation of the school or for the students. And I have, I think the legislative auditor had detailed it was about 20.
Page 12. Thank you. At the top.
Thank you. About $20,000 for the Purpich School, $21,316 per student at the Purpich School, and the Crosswinds School is $18,214 per student.
And Madam Chair, that was the most recent that the office reported to us, and that was with declining enrollment and fewer employees. I believe the employees from 2010 to the fall of 2016 dropped from 84 to 69. So with that kind of per pupil spending, we do need to take note of that being a very generous amount, even though we know some of it is included in housing. Any further comments before we hear from our testifiers in the audience?
Madam Chair?
Oh, yes. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment. I think it doesn't only count for the arts, the housing and that sort of thing, but it's the outreach program that we know has been diminished and not run as we had expected it to, but there is still an outreach program, and so a lot of the funding has gone to that.
Thank you for the clarification. Representative Loon, may we proceed with testifiers?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Representative Erdl has a question before we begin our break.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not really a question, just a quick comment. And we'll be quick because, you see, I have a doctor's appointment. I have to leave. But, you know, I would
I would support moving this on to the Finance Committee. But that said, you know, I have toured the Purpose Center a couple times. You know, been impressed at the work being done there. Disappointed that some of these findings of the auditor's report haven't been followed. You know, I certainly would encourage that there be remedies made to this. But I just needed to say that in my visits to Purpich and talking to students there, although it's been a few years now, you know, I was doing that in my role as chairman of the Legacy Committee, and I was impressed with what was happening in the school. So with that, you guys vote on it. Later.
You must have therapy. Yes. Is that correct? Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, keep improving with that knee. Representative Loon, before we move to the testifiers, though, I did want to call attention to page 25. This is in regard to crosswinds and action that may or may not have been taken formally by the board, and to what extent that might be concerning to us today. Would you comment on page 25 in the paragraphs that the report talks about in regard to the conveyance of crosswinds?
Yes, Madam Chair, and this is a point that has given me a fair amount of concern. So, you know, there's kind of two important questions here, and one is the Purpich Center for the Arts and the Arts High School, and then the other is the operation of crosswinds, intertwined but two sort of separate issues. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very concerning to me to read that when the conveyance of crosswinds to Purpich was done, that there was no formal action taken by the board of Purpich mm-hmm. to sort of formally endorse that concept or that idea. And I guess it just really calls into question sort of the engagement of the board in this process, if they understood what they were undertaking in bringing sort of the operation of a school, another school, into their range of responsibilities. And as we know, there were processes that were not followed that every school district has to with regards to information on special education funds and others going to the Department of Education. So, again, it's just another sort of really concerning point of information as to whether or not an agency operating under the full authority and direction of a board, as this has been, was the proper way to have this be functioning, and whether or not this was really a decision that the board was in favor or not of. I think that is a very valid question.
And furthermore, Madam Chair, there were board members who didn't even know that crosswinds was a part of the operation, according to this report. Thank you very much. Let's move to
Madam Chair.
Representative Ward.
Thank you. Very quickly, as you move forward, I think you've really nailed it. This was not an engaged board. They were under the direction of the current administrator, and they took what she said. And we knew many of these problems were going on, and that's why we pushed so hard for an audit. So now we have some concrete information that we can take action on. And I'll make some comments about that later, but you've really nailed the situation. The board did not know, and as I testified last year when we were dealing with a potential bill, or a bill that we had, the board didn't know what they didn't know. And they did not know what their responsibilities were. And those who started asking questions didn't last long on the board. I think the legislature wasn't doing their job over years. You have identified that there were a number of legislative audits over years. Why wasn't the legislature paying attention to that? So I think we all bear some responsibility, those of us who have been around for a while, we all bear some responsibility for that. So I'm hoping that we can fix it. Thank you.
And the legislature was aware. We did follow up, and we received a lot of pushback. So it's not that we didn't keep our eye on this, but there was, as I said, a great deal of opposition to our taking a close look at Purpich. So with that, are there those in the audience who would like to speak
from the perspective of the Perpich Center for the Arts and the Arts High School before we move to those with concerns about crosswinds or with ideas about crosswinds. Would anyone wishing to do that please come forward to share your testimony? Please say your name for the record and begin, and welcome to our committee.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Julie Workman, and I am the Vice Chair of the Perpich Center for Arts Education Board. Thank you for the opportunity to speak before you today. On our 14-member board, five board members have served only 2 years. In September of 2016, three new members, of which I am one, were appointed. At our first meeting in January 2017, six more new appointees joined us. During our annual meeting on February 9th, we elected a board chair and vice chair, reestablished six committees, and created two new ones, which will have regular meetings to accomplish the work. We hired an interim executive director who has been on the job since February 16th. A permanent executive director will be hired and in place on or before July 1st. The current board did not contribute to any of the negative findings in the OLA reports, and key recommendations are being addressed and implemented. In response to the biggest concern in the OLA audit, on Tuesday, February 28th, the board voted unanimously to recommend to the legislature the conveyance of crosswinds to St. Paul Public Schools on July 1st, 2017. If this is moving too quickly, we request you to consider a management contract arrangement with St. Paul's Public Schools between July 1st and January 15th, 2018. This action will provide the resources to begin to restore the arts education outreach program, which has been significantly reduced for several years. The library, another linchpin of PCAE, was moved several years ago to a much smaller place, and most of it is in boxes. This important resource for students and the outreach program has been severely restricted as a result. The problems at PCAE have developed over a number of years. We are asking this committee to allow this new board the time to rectify these long-standing deficits and to report to you in the 2018 session before taking any potential action. We take our work and responsibilities seriously, and we'll continue to use the OLA reports as our roadmap in restoring the potential of the PCAE, which has benefited so many over the past 32 years. Thank you for your consideration.
Ms. Workman, I have a concern about the academic performance of our student population at Perpich, as it is not at the level that I would expect at a special high school like this. So what assurances do we have if we would go the path that you're proposing, that we're going to see an improvement in academic performance as well as in their artistic performance?
I believe that would be the responsibility of the new executive director. The board would certainly work closely with that person in reviewing the data and any suggestions or courses of action that that person might have in terms of raising the academic performance.
And I think you know, Ms. Workman, that not even the MCA was given to students, and that's a requirement in law. Furthermore, the world's best workforce is a requirement for the arts high school as well. So you have a lot of work to do, from my perspective, to ensure that the students who apply and are accepted to Perpich also receive that top-notch education that they would get in another public setting. And I guess I have another question to ask you, too. What severance packages were given to the former executive director or staff or board members?
I do not have that information.
And, Ms. Workman, would you provide that with us when you and the other board members know that?
Yes.
Thank you. Members, are there any questions for Ms. Workman? Then we'll hear from our other testifier. Welcome. Please say your name for the record, and you're going to have to make sure you're sitting by the microphone. and adjust it if you need.
While they're shifting, may I comment on your question, please?
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I challenged, even before the resignation of the executive director, what was going to be happening with any kind of a severance package, and I was assured both before and after that the conclusion was that it was in keeping, MMB has guidelines, and it was in keeping with whatever the structure of the state's decisions. So it wasn't anything more or less than what the state dictates.
Thank you, Representative Ward. We'll look forward to that specific information. Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and esteemed members of the committee. My name is Ahava Silky Jones, and I am the new principal of the Purpich Arts High School. I'm honored to speak to you today about the continued relevance, impact, and dire need for the Purpich Center for Arts Education, both historically, currently, and for our future of students, families, and communities throughout the state of Minnesota. Throughout our 32-year history, we have shaped, championed, and informed arts education statewide. The desperation of students and teachers expressed yesterday to help save Purpich after learning of this bill weighs on me as I consider the catastrophic impact a comprehensive closure of this agency would cause. The Purpich Center is so much more than a school or an outreach provider to so many. Purpich is an identity. Purpich is a dream. Purpich is quite literally a lifesaver. It's an indispensable component of the fabric of the communities which we have touched, which has included over tens of thousands of students and teachers over three decades. The arts represent over a $2 billion economic footprint statewide, and the Purpich Center is a core, tangible commitment by the state of Minnesota to prioritize not only the compilation and dissemination of best practices in the arts, but to take ownership over the training, present, and direct instruction. Purpich creates space in Minnesota for artists to thrive. It encourages our most creative members to embrace their perspective, live in it, and become something greater because of it. In the absence of Purpich, many young artists are relegated to the periphery in their schools, never heard or supported, never allowed to see their gifts flourish. We lose when that happens. Purpich and Purpich alone does that. It brings artists and teachers together from across the state so they can learn from one another. So Purpich has to evolve as a landscape. As the changing landscape has not rendered the institution obsolete, but rather indispensable. When I walked through Purpich for the first time, I was floored by the energy that emanates from its walls, representing over 4,000 students that have attended Purpich. Yes, enrollment has declined in recent years, and to that we have taken concrete steps to address this challenge. With the support of a strong team, we have made strides towards both our short and long-term goals. We have yielded over a 900% increase in student applications from Congressional District 7, which you mentioned earlier. We had one of Purpich's all-time attendance rates at an information session last month amidst very public political criticism. And we are hosting a summer camp for students in grades 8 through 12 for the first time in decades to plant the seed about Purpich in the hearts and minds of the next generation. We have not yet achieved the growth we envision, but we have a comprehensive plan in place, and we are committed to seeing it through until we fulfill that mission. Graduates of Purpich are state and nationally recognized. We received over 97 scholastic recognitions this year, second only to a school with a population nearing 2,000. And the one thing that makes all Purpich graduates stand out is they determined that Purpich was the key to their success. Purpich develops artists and gives back to our communities, volunteering at a rate of only three times the state average. And our outreach work has expanded to include regional centers that are crafted to meet the needs and give autonomy to district leaders. Our Turnaround Arts program is changing the way schools work, providing whole school arts integrated intervention, and in turn creating life-altering climate and culture changes on campuses struggling to embrace and support diverse learners. Purpich has championed the development of the 21st century workforce, using the arts to bridge the achievement gap and ensuring Minnesota is one of the states leading this work. Purpich has struggled as of late, but Purpich isn't lost. As one of my esteemed arts faculty members says, the Purpich name is a promise between the people of Minnesota and the school to provide the highest standard of creative excellence. And to do this, we must not be afraid to grow, to change, and adjust. Leadership comes from the inside out, and we are ready. And to that I say we are ready to evolve, to grow, to invest in the aspects of our work that have the most impact, and to change as needed to fulfill the mission to serve our students of Greater Minnesota. Access from all socioeconomic backgrounds, racial and cultural groups, to identify our groups, adjust our tactics until we are not just reaching but exceeding our key role in maintaining Minnesota as a state that prioritizes advancing arts education. PERPET is not just a part of some of us, but is a part of all of us. Thank you.
So, Ms. Jones, how many arts specialists are now on staff? I mean, what areas are you covering? Because we learned in the report that visual arts is about the only viable arts program. So what is happening with music and other?
When you say arts specialist, do you mean in reference to outreach or at our high school?
No, I'm at your school.
Oh, at the school we have all arts areas represented. Students may concentrate in media, visual, theater, dance, and literary arts.
And there's music.
As well as music.
And you have someone on staff now?
Yes, we have full-time staff members in every art area at the Arts High School.
Thank you.
Yes, no problem.
Thank you, Ms. Jones. I'll call forward. I guess now we're going to move to the Crosswinds, the superintendent, interim superintendent from St. Paul.
Madam Chair?
Support? Yes.
Well, they're coming down. I wondered if Ms. Silky Jones would give us her background, just briefly a little bit of where you come from, what you bring to the school, please?
Very briefly. Thank you.
Absolutely. I started in August with the PERPET Center for Arts Education. I have a master's in arts and education from the Harvard Graduate School of Education, as well as a school administrative license and a master's in school leadership. I spent over 6 years as a director of fine arts for the University of Chicago Charter High School and time as a school administrator in the Newark Public Schools.
Welcome, Mr. Superintendent. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Good morning. My name is John Tyne. I'm Superintendent of St. Paul Public Schools. Chair Erickson, members of the committee, it's a pleasure to visit with you today concerning the possibility of a transfer, legislative approval to transfer Crosswinds Public School or Charter or Crosswinds Schools to St. Paul Public Schools. I have a leave behind that I have asked to be handed out. So rather than to read it completely through, to talk about a couple of things that are really important to St. Paul Public Schools, but more so than St. Paul Public Schools are the students and families that are currently attending school at Crosswinds and the staff members that work there. This is not the first time that I guess I've been involved with the transfer of one building to another district. And this has happened successfully in Minneapolis, in Richfield, and in Roseville. And what we're looking for in St. Paul Public Schools is to provide a seamless transition for the kids that attend the Crosswinds School, to provide the depth that they need and the stability that they need to make it a successful undertaking. There is no doubt that there needs to be a change, and that is not only shared by St. Paul Public Schools, by the parents, by the staff, but it's also shared by the PERPET board, who unanimously put forth a resolution to, I believe, the legislature, stating that they would ask that the building be transferred to St. Paul Public Schools. And rather than to bore you with details concerning the information that you can read at your leisure, I would stand for any questions that you may have about the transfer of the property, the roles and responsibilities that St. Paul Public Schools would have, and the enthusiasm that we have for taking this undertaking.
Thank you, Mr. Tyne.
Thank you.
Are there questions for the superintendent?
Madam Chair.
Representative Ward.
If others won't ask, I will ask a couple of things. I think it would be helpful for you to share some of your background with EMID and the whole transition evolution of the integration programs in the state, because I think you were very closely involved in that, and so you're a good person to tell us about it.
Thank you, Representative Gore.
Mr. Tine.
Sure. Members of the committee, there's an old saying, if you live long enough, you get to meet everybody. So my experience is quite lengthy in Minnesota school districts. In fact, I happen to be serving in the Roseville School District when St. Paul and Roseville worked together to really start the integration program and develop the first joint integration, voluntary integration program in Minnesota. Later on, we were joined by North St. Paul, Maplewood, and then as we progressed, a number of other districts joined. And it became known as the East Metro Integration District. Part of that integration plan was to develop two schools. One was a elementary school called Harambe. The other was a middle school concept called Crosswinds. Over a period of time, the populations in all of the member districts started to change. And I can speak as a former superintendent in Roseville Public Schools. When I first arrived in Roseville, our minority population, our students of color, were about 9%. At the present time, they're in excess of 50%. So the needs for integration and the movement of kids seem to diminish, plus a decline in student enrollment in a number of districts made that rather difficult for districts to give up their students. Because we knew that Harambe was going to close, Roseville Public Schools stepped forward to accept the responsibility of managing that school. And I'm very proud to say that it was a seamless transition. The only thing that our families noticed when they showed up for school the first day that we operated the building was that the name on the outside was different. Other than that, when students walked in, they happened to see the same teachers. The program was the same. It was a chance for us to offer a year-round program and to focus on environmental science. And it's been a great experience. After that, I can tell you that Minneapolis and Robbinsdale followed the same pathway and also accepted the responsibility. And to my knowledge, both of those schools are operating well and within the beliefs and the legislation that created them. Crosswinds has suffered a little bit through the decrease in population. And a couple of things that they have at Crosswinds that we think that we would be very helpful with is, one, the integration, because, as you know, St. Paul is a very diverse and probably the most diverse urban district. We have over 38,500 students, and about 78% of our students are students of color. So we think that we could provide that. The arts, we do feature arts in our school. In fact, we have one of the best art high schools in the state, if not in the region and in the United States, Creative Arts School in downtown Minneapolis, or downtown St. Paul, excuse me. We don't go to Minneapolis. We're thinking about it, but we haven't moved here yet. But we think it would be a natural fit for us to offer that program. We also have experience in operating a year-round school, which we do right now. Crossroads is a year-round school, a K-5, which would be a natural feeder to the 6-10 program that is at Crosswinds right now. Our proposal would be to increase that year, 1 year at a time, and turn it into a 6-12. And that's very similar to the Washington Technology School that we have in St. Paul that has been extremely successful with over 2,000 students right now. We feel that we can offer also as a chance for us to offer an environmental science program to inner city students that would be a great draw and very attractive. Bottom line, a number of the students, a large percentage of the students that attend Crosswinds right now are St. Paul Public School residents, and we would like to have them back in our family. We are working very hard to create an experience that's going to be positive for all of our kids, not just some of our kids. And we believe, we've turned the tide on enrollment. In fact, I just looked at the enrollment today, and enrollment in our elementary schools since October 1st has increased. And total students are down less than 50 students for the entire year out of 38,500 students. So we think we're making progress and we want to move forward. And I know I'm a little bit long-winded, but it goes with the job.
Thank you, Superintendent Tine. Representative Loon, have there been others who've shown interest in Crosswinds?
Madam Chair, I think that's still an open question. I know the school is physically located in the South Washington School District, and there may be some interest on their part, but I don't believe they've put forward a formal proposal at this time.
Thank you. There's a Bert Strasberg in the audience. Would you please come forward, sir, to testify? Thank you, Superintendent.
Thank you.
Good to see you again.
Nice to see you. Thank you.
Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Yep. Well, good morning. My name is Bert Strasberg, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here today, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I am the executive director of Woodbury Leadership Academy, and we are a K-7 charter school of 254 students that has been leasing space at Crosswinds School for the past 3 years. Because Crosswinds is a state-owned building, our lease is with the Minnesota Department of Administration and is approved and executed by Purpose Center for the Arts. Since December, we have been in the process of negotiating a new lease for the 2017-2018 school year with Purpich and the state in good faith. These talks ended 2 weeks ago when we were notified by Purpich that changes were on the horizon. Not having a lease in place for next year at this point in the school year, we're only 6 months away from the start of the next school year, puts our educational institution at significant risk. Not being stable for a school of choice impacts enrollment, staff retention, finances, and the list goes on. In addition, Woodbury has very little, essentially none, rental property available that would meet our needs, especially on such short notice. The bottom line for us is WLA, our school, needs at least one more year at the Crosswinds building so that we can effectively transition out of that school. Please keep in mind that decisions that are made regarding Crosswinds and Purpich may have many ripple effects. In this instance, it could end up closing a growing and thriving school, we're only in our third year, based upon timing and conditions. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, sir. Are there questions for the testifier? Representative Jessup.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If you could, the students that attend the school, whereabouts are they geographically located? Are they all amongst the Twin Cities, predominantly in that area? Where are the families that would be affected by whatever decisions that come?
Sure. Mr. Strasberg.
Yep, thank you. A majority of our students do come from District 833, so South Washington County Schools, so Woodbury, Cottage Grove, North St. Paul. We do pull students also from Stillwater School District and some from St. Paul.
Okay. Other questions from members? Thank you, Mr. Strasberg.
Thank you.
Further questions for the author? Representative Kunish-Padin.
Thank you. And I'm just going to go back to Purpich for a minute. If we were to convene that school, what district would it go to? Or what are the possibility, or what are the plans for that?
Madam Chair.
Representative Bloom.
Madam Chair, Representative, for the Purpich Arts High School or for Crosswinds?
Purpich, I'm sorry.
Purpich. That would be a question to be determined. The school, it's not just a school. It's a property with a dormitory and acreage and that. So I think that would be a significant question to grapple with as to what would happen to that property. My presumption is it would be under the authority of the Department of Administration, and then from there determine whether they would sell the building or if there was another public purpose for it that it could be utilized for.
Thank you. Are there any school districts that have stepped up and are interested in absorbing that into their district?
Madam Chair?
Thank you. Now, the good question, no, none that have come forward so far. But, again, I think we're early in the process. But I'm not aware of any being interested in sort of taking over the operation of Purpich Arts High School.
Okay. And then just one question. Yes, Crossroads now. I'm back to that. Can you talk about the diversity of that school and how keeping this school open might fit in with developing teachers of color?
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. I think appears to be part of, as I read through sort of the proposal that St. Paul Public Schools has put forward in their interest in sort of taking over Crosswinds, that is of interest to them. I think it's a fine purpose. It's something that the policy committee and the finance committee have looked at initiatives to try to increasing our number of teachers of color and the diversity of the people leading our classrooms. I think, there are two different situations, but there have been difficulties with Crosswinds as well. And some of it has come, I think, from instability and leadership, maybe with Perpich as the director of that school, other things. But certainly they've seen families who have left the program. It's a very small number of students currently at Crosswinds. But I have received a few emails from parents who have chosen to put their child at Crosswinds, who feel it has been the right setting for their child when maybe they didn't fit in another school setting, and that is something that I think we need to weigh carefully. We are a state that prides ourselves on providing options for parents to find the best educational setting for their children. Not all kids do well in a traditional public school setting, and they need options. And so I think that is something that needs to figure heavily into our decision-making process as we determine best what to do with Crosswinds.
Representative Ward, would you like to offer any information as to our next steps from your perspective, since you've been one of our leaders on this charge?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the opportunity for this. Arts education is well documented as a key path to learning and development for all of our students. Social, emotional development, learning, creativity that's applied to all areas of life. Last session, we in this committee passed and supported a bill to hold the Perpich Board accountable. The bill had broad support in the House. We worked really hard to get the OLA's priority report done. The Senate did not allow the bill to move forward. And that was because one senator in particular thought that it was presumptuous of us to think that we would know how to fix anything in this organization, and that we should not dictate a solution before the OLA had given us a report. We wanted to give the board the opportunity to start the assessment process and begin moving toward addressing the well-known and well-documented issues. And in conversations with the auditor's office, we understood that many organizations who are being audited do start taking steps immediately, and the auditor is used to working with agencies in transition and still doing a very thorough report. So the board chose to do nothing, or the legislature chose to do nothing. So now we have the OLA's report, and some of us have been working throughout the last year to position the board to be in a strong position, to be filled with people who have the skills, talent, background, and commitment to making the changes that are needed. That board is moving forward with strength, wisdom, and commitment to revive PCAE, that's Perpich Center for the Performing or for the Arts Education, to its appropriate and needed place in the state's arts leadership role. This role is needed, desired, and expected by the arts communities throughout the states. I have heard from many of them. I'm sure we will hear from them in the future hearings. I think that it's presumptuous of us to legislate this conclusion. This was one of the options that the auditor suggested would be a possible future. This bill shuts down any alternative to closing off this state asset with no replacement. There are better ways to address the challenges PCAE and Crosswind Schools face to live into the expectations and needs of the students, families, communities, and citizens of the state of Minnesota. Madam Chair, I request a roll call.
Roll call has been requested. Representative Loon, closing comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. And I want to especially thank Representative Ward. We've had a few discussions about this I came to the decision to propose this legislation. And just to harken back to my opening comments, I think arts education for children is incredibly important. And the proposal that is before you today is not a statement saying that it's not important or that we shouldn't do it. But I think we have ample evidence in this report and going back a number of years that the agency that was established to do this is not functioning properly, and it hasn't for a long time. So in proposing to close PERPCH as we know it, I think it's a challenge on all of us to decide how we can provide that opportunity to students and do that better. I'm not convinced that keeping the same model but having new board members is going to accomplish that goal, even though I have been, I will say, very impressed with the current board chair, Mr. Vanderkooy. They have been moving swiftly. They have been taking very responsible action. And so I have great confidence in some of the new people who are on the board. Again, but I just don't feel that it's a model that bodes well for success in the way it's written. I just think it's a flawed model. So, again, in the spirit of trying to move forward with saying the past is something that is probably not going to work in the future, how do we move forward and find a new solution? And it's in that spirit that I would ask the members to consider supporting this so we can continue to have discussions. This will have to go through a number of committees. We'll have a lot of dialogue. And I just pledge to all members personally that I am open to ideas, amendments, thoughts on what next steps should be. So with that, Madam Chair, I would ask for the committee's support to continue having what is a difficult but a very necessary conversation as a legislature that is responsible for the funding of this agency.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And with that, the Chair renews Representative Loon's motion that House File 1825 be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. A roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Erickson.
Yes.
Daniels.
Yes.
Mariani. R.
Yes.
Bennett.
Yes.
Bly.
No.
Christensen.
Yes.
Grassel.
Yes.
Haley.
Yes.
Jessa.
Yes.
Kunesh-Podein.
No.
Lee.
No.
McQuaid.
No.
Pryor.
No.
Rarick.
Yes.
Erdahl. Ward.
No.
There being 9 yeses and 6 noes, the motion does prevail. The bill is re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. Thank you, Representative Loon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Committee.
And thank you, Office of the Legislative Auditor, first and foremost, for your great work and for your presence this morning to provide those extra details that we needed to hear for those who may not have read the reports. We appreciate your attendance very much, and to those in the audience who came to hear this. Members, our last bill this morning is House File 1680, Representative Bennett. And members, we also have an amendment here, and this bill will be referred to the Committee on Education Finance as well. Welcome to the testifying table, Representative Bennett. Will you please move your file?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And do I start with my amendment, Madam Chair?
No, or move your work.
Okay,
no.
I would move House File 1680.
Representative Bennett moves House File 1680. She also offers the H2 amendment. And I believe, Representative Bennett, your amendment is more or less
a technical change from 2017 to 2019 on page 4. Anything else that you need to say about that amendment?
No, pretty straightforward.
Okay, all those in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those
aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails, and the A2 amendment is adopted, and the bill is in the order in which you wish it. Please explain, Representative Bennett. And you need to introduce yourself, please, for the record as well.
Yes, Madam Chair and committee members, I'm Representative Peggy Bennett. I represent District 27A. And I'd like to start out by saying that we are experiencing a silent epidemic. Every 6 minutes, a child is sexually assaulted in the United States. That's really dire. According to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, 1 in 5 girls and 1 in 20 boys are victims of sexual abuse. And so that would be the impetus for this bill. In our schools, we teach children fire drills. We teach them tornado drills. We teach them bus safety. Even now, we teach them about intruder safety and protection. But we do not protect them or teach them about sexual predators and the dangers that are with that. So that's what this bill is about, and I'm just going to briefly tell you what it is, and I have a couple of testifiers as well. But I think it's important for us to ensure that children are taught to protect themselves, because experiencing sexual assault, sexual violence, as a child in particular is life-altering, which I'm sure you will hear from our testifiers. And it's my intent with this to give children a voice and to teach them to have a voice so they can speak up if they are being sexually assaulted. So this bill, which is called Aaron's Law, and Aaron's Law is actually a national endeavor to get teaching on things like good touch, bad touch, how to speak up, to get those into our schools. And so far, 26 schools in the United States have adopted.
States.
Thank you very much. 26 states in our country have adopted Aaron's Law, and it's my hopes that Minnesota will become the 27th state. Briefly telling you about the bill, this is, first of all, I'll say this is not a mandate. The intent of this bill is to heighten the awareness of what's going on and what's needed in our schools, and it gives schools some ideas and suggestions on how to implement such education, which would be part of the health curriculum. It involves some it's suggested in-service training, which encourages districts to train staff and school board members on how to disclose child sexual abuse and complying with mandate reporting. It also lets schools know that there are grants available, and they can accept those from both private and other sources, including our federal government just passed a law, I believe, last year that provides funding grants for schools who would like to implement some kind of a program. This is not a huge weight on schools. It's really more like a once-a-year education at an age-appropriate level. It would involve the Department of Human Health and Services in Minnesota here to look at and post some suggested curriculums that would be good for schools. That is something that I'm working with Mr. Koppel and the DHS on. That might change a little bit. There are already quite a few curriculums posted on websites such as the Aaron's Law website where schools can look at ideas for that. It also requires the Commissioner of Education to make a report in 2 years that would just survey schools on what they're currently doing with child sexual abuse prevention programs, what kind of curriculum they're using, where they're getting their funding, just get a handle on those things. So, Madam Chair, if you're okay with this, let me have my testifiers say something.
Thank you very much, Representative Bennett. And, yes, I believe we have Elizabeth Sullivan from Empower Survivors with us. So welcome, Ms. Sullivan. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Elizabeth Sullivan. I'm Elizabeth Sullivan and the founder of Empower Survivors, which is a nonprofit organization for adult survivors of childhood sexual abuse. I began this organization because as a survivor that kept quiet until the age of 42, I realized the importance that there was to have something for survivors.
most communities don't understand the trauma of child rape. The reason that we need early education, we're teaching in the college levels, we're more about rape, but over 70% of the rape is to children. Most will stay quiet. I have talked to thousands of survivors of childhood sexual rape and abuse. Most of them have never told anybody. I've talked to grandmothers where this has gone for generations in their families, and they're asking, why isn't this being taught? We have programs for bullying, programs for a lot of other things, but our kids are not being empowered to speak, and we really need to give voice to this taboo subject and realize that we have a lot of kids that are sexually abused that go on to have early pregnancies. They're being labeled as ADHD when really what's happening is maybe Uncle Joe is molesting them, or mom or dad, or a coach or something else. Over 90% of these perpetrators are people that the children love, know, or trust. Less than 10% will come from a stranger. I myself had 3 offenders. I never told anybody. I surprised my family by basically having a breakdown at 42. And after that, after finding some healing and understanding how huge of a problem this really was, I realized I couldn't just stay silent and I couldn't just let this keep on happening. They say the statistics, now yours were a little bit different, but they say the statistics are 1 in 4 girls, 1 in 6 boys. But I would challenge that because the majority of survivors that I've ever spoke to, they've never said anything. They weren't empowered because you're getting told as a child that you make me do this to you. That if you tell me, if you tell anybody, I'm gonna hurt your family or your puppy. They groom you. They know exactly what needs to be done. I heard one perpetrator say, the way that I know a kid, that I finally had that kid after getting to a certain point in the grooming, because these are people that they aren't the stranger on the corner. They're the ones that can connect to that little kid that is looking for love and is looking to be seen and heard. And when that person comes and grooms them, that perpetrator knows at a certain point by looking at that child, there's something in their eye that says, I've got that child. And they hook them in, and they sexually abuse them. And then these kids keep this to themselves. They keep that trauma in their body. It's not something you get over. It's something you have to process through. So it's vital that kids be able to give voice to this, be taught how to give voice to it. But it's even more than we can't put it on our kids. Adults need to be educated on trauma and how this affects the child. I know I'm making this too long, but I also have to say for people that say, well, we don't have the money to take care of this, I get that, but in the long run as a society, we're paying for this because a large majority of our prison inmates were sexually abused. 2/3 of alcoholics were sexually abused. You have people going on to drug and alcohol abuse because they were sexually abused. It's in every community, every religion, every economic realm. It's everywhere. Statistically in this room, there's going to be
a handful of survivors. It's everywhere, and I think that we owe it to our children and our future children to be able to empower them that if somebody that they love and care for touches them or rapes them, that they can give voice to it. And if they can't give voice to it, that the adults that are around them can recognize the signs and symptoms and not just label them as a delinquent or ADHD or some other disorder. It's they're being raped, and they need to have their voices heard.
Thank you, Ms. Sullivan. In states where they have enacted Aaron's Law, what changes are we seeing in regard to curriculum or the educational aspect that's really addressed in Representative Bennett's bill? Can you comment on that?
You go ahead.
Okay, our next testifier will. So introduce yourself, Ms. Kane, for the record.
My name is April Kane. And
Steve, you could proceed with your testimony.
You prefer me to do it that
way? Yes, and then answer the question. Thank you.
Okay.
Because it might be contained in your testimony.
Okay.
Welcome to our committee.
Thank you so much. My name is April Kane, and thanks to Representative Bennett for moving this bill forward. And she was kind enough to say that this training is one day per year. It's actually 1 hour per year. And Aaron's Law has been introduced or passed in every single state in the entire country except two, Idaho and Wyoming. I am a survivor of sexual abuse from my parent, my father, and my earliest memory is being abused in my parents' bed. Another very early memory is being abused by him in a bathtub with an adult male naked in the bath with me. When I was 11 years old, my father, I was sent to visit him where he was working and on the bed, asked me if I had started my menstrual period. And as an adult, I understand he wanted to know if he could impregnate me. When I was 12 years old, I had a friend come to my house and my father embraced her in a full body sexual embrace and would not let go. When I pried him off of her, I never invited any friends over to the house again. I lived in an apartment building, and in the basement there was a laundry room, and anyone in the building could go there. Very often the front door of our building did not lock, so anyone could come off the street and go in the laundry room. I was allowed to go down there as a small child by myself. I should not have been allowed to go down there alone. I was sexually assaulted and raped by a stranger in the laundry room. When I came up to my apartment, my mother understood that I was upset, but I had no vocabulary to describe abuse. I had no way to explain to my mother in a way she could understand what happened, and she simply said, "You are not allowed to go down there anymore." And it was never mentioned again until today. And I'm 53 years old, and I have never told my story, and I beat even you, Elizabeth. This man who raped me lived across the street from me in an apartment building, and when I left my house in the morning to walk to the bus, he would watch me outside of his window. I understand now that he is a pedophile, but back then I did not have any words to describe who he was. I've had nightmares my entire life of sexual abuse. We did not have a sex offender registry at that time, or perhaps my mother would have understood the dangers of allowing me as a small child to wander around alone. In Minnesota, we had a bus aide who abused the five children on the bus, and one of them spoke up and said, "He touched my privates." Because she had been taught to speak up, she saved herself and the other children, and the predator can be put in jail. A teacher in the South St. Paul School District, Mr. Babbitt, it's reported in the news, sexually assaulted 10 children. They all kept it a secret until one had a breakdown. Please consider passing Aaron's Law to stop the suffering of the children in Minnesota. Without Aaron's Law and without being given a vocabulary to report abuse, it can lead to years of suffering that, as Elizabeth says, doesn't just go away. And I don't believe anyone has the right to endanger the life of a child or their well-being, not a school, not a superintendent, not a principal, not a union. No one has the right to throw away the life of a child, and that's what happened to me. And I don't want it to happen to anybody else. Thank you for listening to my testimony, and thank you for the important work that all of you do.
Thank you, Ms. Kane. And so now, can you answer that question that I asked of Ms. Sullivan?
Is there any chance you could repeat the question, and I will answer?
Well, I'm wondering, in the states where this has been enacted, what difference has it made?
Yes, it has made a difference, and this is proven by news articles that the children do disclose sexual abuse in the states where Aaron's Law is being taught. And you can Google it yourself and see all the stories, or we could provide it for you, but it is making a difference, and the children are disclosing their abuse, and the abusers can be put in jail. And it's important to put a barrier between the sexual predators and the children, and one of those barriers is jail, and another barrier is to give them the vocabulary to disclose. But, yes, they do disclose.
And, Ms. Kane, is there one state or two or three or others or more that maybe are doing a more effective job with this kind of legislation in place?
I think we're planning, you know, if this is passed, for 1 hour per year. There are some states that do it twice a year. There's one state I saw they proposed they wanted to do it four times a year. So once 1 hour a year is wonderful. Two is better. I don't know if I answered your question, but in every other state besides Minnesota, this is a mandate that they are required in all schools to teach children that sexual abuse is wrong. In Minnesota, this is a baby step saying that we can if we want to. So in the future, I would think the schools that are requiring it in all schools are helping more children, and one day we may get there.
Thank you, Ms. Kane.
Thank you.
Are there questions for the testifiers? Representative Haley.
Madam Chair, thank you for your testimony and your courage. Is there a model, in, or is that contained in your bill, as to what MDE could recommend to schools so they have something to work from and not have to recreate the wheel by themselves?
Representative Bennett.
I'm sorry, could you ask that again, please?
Or I can answer it if you want, whatever.
Is there a model, Representative Bennett, that MDE could provide for school districts as to a training program that they can use?
There are a number of models, yeah, and I'll maybe let April speak to that.
Yep. Ms. Kane.
Yep. So this has been passed in 26 states, and all 26 states have curriculum. It's very readily available. You can even Google it on the Internet and look at what the states are doing. And so the Minnesota Department of Education can literally choose which one they like. They do not have to recreate the wheel. They can simply put the education on a website that already exists, and all the schools in the state can just use it and present it for 1 hour a year, even at an open assembly. So they do not need to recreate the wheel. One of the most important things here that they teach children, because it's very age-appropriate curriculum. If the child is wearing a bathing suit, they explain this part of your body is private. And if someone's trying to touch you, you should tell a trusted adult. They talk about safe secret and unsafe secret. The predators, 9 out of 10 times, as Elizabeth said, know the child and tell them to keep it secret. And it's explained to them it is not a safe secret. And there's safe touch and unsafe touch. So the curriculum does exist, yes, and is readily available. You can even Google it and see what the states are doing.
Madam Chair,
Representative Bennett.
I'd also add that, and talking with Mr. Koppel, we may actually change this instead of having it report or posted on the DHS website. We may just link to Aaron's Law website. There are probably at least 10 curriculums suggested there. Give schools an idea. And again, the federal government also has enacted legislation that has to do with this as well.
So, Representative Bennett, in most states, is there something available on the Department of Education website as well?
Madam Chair, thank you. That I do not know is a question
I can answer. A lot of the states have their own Aaron's Law website. So I think for Illinois, where it first came up, you can search Illinois Aaron's Law. And the information is there. So many states have their own Aaron's Law website, but it does not have to be done that way. But many have chosen to do that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Other questions? Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, thank you so much for bringing this forward, and thank you so much for your testimony today. I think this will be one warning that we'll never forget. And thank you for sharing and bringing this forward. A question that I have, too, is states that have Aaron's Law, do they have other pieces in place to help children that have been sexually abused? Do they have counselors, or do they have special training in the schools for what to do when the child comes forward and that there's resources available?
Ms. Kane, would you like to answer that?
Yep. So some things we have that are already in statute. So we have mandatory reporters. So all the teachers already, if they find out a student discloses, they must report it. The problem is they don't disclose. So Aaron's Law can be written differently for each state. And, yes, many states have additional trainings involved which help. So, for example, the teacher is a mandatory, they report it, but then what do they do? So some Aaron laws give them additional information how to help that child after they disclose and after they report. Additionally, I think it helps, but you don't have to do it, to give awareness to the parents. So, for example, when I tried sort of to disclose to my mother, something happened, she had no awareness. But if she had had a vocabulary of a sexual assault, she could have even said, did someone touch your private area? We might have started a conversation. So some Aaron's laws, yes, do that and provide additional training, but they don't have to. Each state can decide, but some do, yes.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. Any other questions, Representative Kunish-Gradin?
I, too, want to thank you for your strength and courage to come here and share your stories with us. Can you tell us about the successes in these other states? Has it been, how productive has it been, and how many kids have we been able to touch and connect with and give the support that they needed?
Ms. Kane, would you like to try that again?
It's been amazing. You can go online, and I watch Erin on Facebook, and all the time she's putting up article after article about this child disclosed and this sexual predator was put in jail. And the thing about it is that herself, when she got this law passed in Illinois, she said, I'm not stopping now. I'm going to pass this in the entire country. And she will. It is inevitable that this will be passed in the entire country because, as Elizabeth said, to not do it makes no sense for anybody, but also even financially to the state. These people who've been sexually abused, when their lives derail, it costs the states hundreds of millions of dollars to try to fix people. We cannot, when a tragedy happens, we can't go back in time. We have to prevent it now. So if you want, I recommend people look at Erin on Facebook and you see all these examples, but also understand that she herself, when she was successful in her state, she said, that's not good enough. I have to protect all the children in the entire country, and I won't stop until that happens. And, you know, that was the way I felt in Minnesota. I won't stop until Minnesota protects its children from sexual abuse. But there are some where the children have been abused for years. Because what happens is the predators can abuse 50, 100, 200 children in their lifetime, and when they're not caught, they abuse the children for years. I mean, the torture, the sexual torture is endless, and they abuse many children. So when we catch them, we stop the abuse of that one child, but also all the rest of the children they could abuse. Mr. Babbitt in South St. Paul School was a career pedophile. He had his own server. He had double encrypted passwords. He used pot and alcohol, and he drugged the children so they couldn't even resist when he attacked them. These people are career pedophiles, and when we catch one, we can save literally 100 children. The girl that spoke out on the bus about the bus aid saved all of those children. So we might hear in the reports about one child speaking out, but that one child can save 100 other children. So it's been amazingly successful, amazingly.
Thank you. Representative Makewade.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just keep it brief. I just want to thank the testifiers for coming today and Representative Bennett for bringing this and specifically walking across the floor to have me sign on to it, because this is such a small thing that we can do that has such a great impact. And I think that's been proven through the testimony. So thank you for bringing this and for literally changing thousands of Minnesota children's lives. So thank you so much.
Well, Ms. Kane has been persistent, and we recognize that, yes. So thank you, Ms. Kane and Ms. Sullivan, for providing testimony. Thank you, Representative Bennett. Closing comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Just as a former teacher of 33 years, I'd like to drive this right home to my classrooms. And when you look at these statistics with 1 in 5 girls, 1 in 20 boys, for the girls, that would have been about 5 students every year in my first grade classroom. And actually, one of my students years ago, it came known after she went through my first grade classroom and got to third grade, we found out she was being sexually abused and had been. And I can't help but thinking, if I would have had this curriculum in my classroom, we could have stopped that earlier. So this is huge. And, you know, kids have been my world
for many, many years, and they still are. I believe they're a treasure. They're a treasure for our state and our country now and in the future. So I hope that we can get this enacted and start on that road to protecting them because they deserve it. So thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
Thank you, Representative Bennett. With that, the Chair renews Representative Bennett's motion that House File 1680, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails, and the bill is on its way. Thank you very much, Representative Bennett and testifiers. Members, we will next meet next Tuesday, but on Monday we will post the delete everything amendment to the department's policy bill. That will be my vehicle. So you'll be able to read that Monday at 8:15. Tuesday in committee, we will have an overview and receive testimony. Thursday, we'll do the markup and hopefully send the bill out. The amendment deadline, and I think you're aware of this already because we have good communication between our CAs here and our DFL research. Amendment deadline will be noon on Wednesday. So we're going to give you some extra time to prepare amendments. So we look forward to next week being a big week for us. We're going to be the committee that meets deadline, and we look forward to culminating as a lot of our business, although we will not certainly end meeting. We will have occasional meetings, I'm sure. With that, the meeting is adjourned.